From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Outright lies in political advertising? Who could imagine such a thing?
The folks who appear to borrow the ad, who sign off on it, are putting straight out lies out on me, and the public needs to know.
Also this week, how do you match a political message to its intended audience? It's a combination of art and science.
You have to convey a message to people that fits them, where they can feel as if it's for them.
We'll also hear about the rash of suicides in Florida's jails and prisons, and we'll explore the steps the state is taking to increase the number of students prepared for the real world of work. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The race between Republican State Senator Corey Simon and Democrat civil rights attorney Darrell Parks is one of the few state Senate races that remains a toss-up this election cycle. The contention has led to a slew of attack ads coming from both sides, but as Tristan Wood reports, the latest ad from the Simon camp has Parks accusing the Republican incumbent of lying.
Simon's latest ad features an animated character meant to represent Parks. The man is standing in a museum holding up bags of money.
Welcome to our Darrell Parks exhibit. Parks is from a divisive species of politician called the Politicus Dividus. Like all such politicians, Parks doesn't solve problems. He profits from them.
The ad was paid for by Simon and two other Republican senators, Ben Albritton and Tom Leak. It goes on to levy strong accusations against Parks for his work as an attorney and other issues that follow the lines of attacks frequently used this cycle by Republicans against Democrats.
Here we see Parks making millions by driving up insurance rates. And here we see him cashing in on racial division, police hatred, even anti-Semitism.
Parks is blasting the ad.
It's a total falsehood lie. And Corey Simon and the folks that are working with him know it's a lie. The folks who appear at the bottom of the ad, who sign off on it, are putting straight out lies out on me, and the public needs to know that they're willing to do anything to try and beat me in this election, but it's not working.
Simon's ad cites three articles to back up its claims. But of those articles, one is a conservative opinion piece, and the others didn't even mention Parks. The claim that Parks made millions in his legal practice by stoking racial division and police hatred stems from a 10-year-old opinion piece on the conservative blog People's Pundit Daily, and Parks defends his work as an attorney.
I've represented some people in situations where they needed someone like me to step up to bring their case, to speak up for them, and I'm very proud of doing that.
When the ad claims that Parks profited off anti-Semitism, an image of Parks is shown with added text mentioning Louis Farrakhan. He is the leader of the Nation of Islam and a famous anti-Semite. But the article cited, a Fox News piece from 2018, never mentions Parks or Farrakhan. When asked to clarify, Simon's camp sent a video of Parks on Fox News in 2014. But that clip has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. In it, host Sean Hannity asks Parks, who is representing the family of Michael Brown, to respond to Farrakhan's call for violence after Brown's 2014 killing by police.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, without question, we have continued and maintained that there should be no violence as it relates to the honor of Michael Brown and his life and what it stood for. So without question, we don't want that to be the legacy of Michael Brown.
The claim Parks has profited off rising property insurance rates comes from a 2022 My News 13 story. It says frivolous lawsuits in Florida contribute to high property insurance costs. Parks wasn't mentioned in that story either, and says he doesn't practice that type of law.
The work that I did at my firm was all about helping people who were in very serious life-threatening situations. Nothing frivolous about that.
Simon spokesperson Aaron Isaac issued a statement defending the ad. In it, she wrote, quote, "Does he really expect us to believe that his money-grubbing business model has changed just because he's running for office?" Unquote. Parks has also lobbed attacks against Simon. For example, Parks accuses Simon of restricting abortion access in Florida in several attack ads. But Simon voted against the state's 6-week abortion ban in 2023 and wasn't a lawmaker when the state's 15-week abortion ban was passed. I'm Tristan Wood.
Ground game, ground game, ground game. That's what Miami Gardens Senator Chevron Jones believes Democrats need to focus on if they want to rack up victories up and down the ballot in Florida. Jones also chairs the Miami-Dade County Democratic Executive Committee. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida, Jones talks about the challenges and the message Democrats are trying to spread in the run-up to November. Here's an excerpt.
What's your biggest challenge down there as the head of the DEC in Miami-Dade County? Republicans have made a lot of inroads. You know, I think it was in 2020 when two Democratic congresswomen were voted out of office. Mm-hmm. Also, some Senate seats were, state mm-hmm. Senate seats were yep. flipped. This socialist brand really worked for Hispanic voters down there, and low turnout also contributed mm-hmm. to those seats being flipped. So mm-hmm. that's all sort of a background for our listeners for what your biggest challenge is to either prevent that from those kinds of things from happening, or what's your biggest challenge down there?
I think the biggest challenge that we're dealing with, we will deal with right now, will be not just turnout. It would be giving the message of what we can deliver for Floridians and how we get that message out to those people, right? Because if we can convey the message of what Democrats have been able to do, or what Democrats have done in the White House, and what we have been trying to accomplish in Tallahassee, it is absolutely making people look at the Republicans sideways, because the Republicans have been in leadership for the past 25 plus years, and we're conveying that message to them. So when you look at high property insurance, when you look at high car insurance, when you look at the education system, when you look at the high cost of living in Florida, you can't look at the Democrats, because we haven't been in charge. The Republicans have. The same individuals who wants to set the state on fire to say that this is, you know, all of this is on fire, where they created the fire.
Mm.
They are the arsenals of all of this, right?
Right.
And so I think the biggest thing that we're conveying down here in Miami-Dade County is that, listen, we carry the message of hope. We carry the message of making sure that what's in your pocketbook's in your pockets stays in your pocketbook, in your pocket, and we add into that, not taking away from it. And that message has been working. So in a way where people can absolutely understand it. And I think that's what we have to do. You have to convey a message to people that fits them, where they can feel as if it's for them.
Are you having trouble in Florida still with raising money, or at all raising money from out-of-state donors? The million voter advantage now by Republicans, it keeps growing. Thoughts on what your strategy is to put Florida back in play, or tell me why Florida is still in play?
Ground game, ground game, ground game, ground game. Listen, I think where money can't take you, ground game will. And that's where Nikki and the local DECs have focused their attention. I know that's where we have focused our attention in the Miami-Dade DEC. We have focused our attention on building a strong ground game, because we know that it's probably one of the most least expensive things that we can do. And that's putting people at the door through volunteers. Volunteers can only take us so far. And I think we realize that. I also think that we have come to a place to where donors have just a tad bit of burnout, because they have been given and they are focused on the presidential. But then you also have those donors who are given to local DECs, because they realize that down ballots are just important to help with voter turnout. So I think we're seeing mixed signals in what that looks like, right? You have some of these donors who are giving to help, but then you have those who are not giving. The National Democratic Party, I know people are saying that the National Party is not playing in Florida. The National Party is absolutely playing in Florida, and they want to see Florida succeed. And I get it. They have to prioritize, what's the polls showing, because that's all they have to work with. And they, while they're working with just the polls, we're working with the people here in Florida. And so we know what's actually happening on the ground. We know the work that's being done. So when we say Florida's in play, whether that's Florida's in play in 2024, or whether mm-hmm. Florida's in play in 2026, Florida is absolutely in play because we're seeing those numbers creeping up as we speak.
That was Miami Gardens Senator Chevron Jones on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Legislative budget leaders expect lawmakers to remain fiscally responsible after being advised today that the state faces potential deficits in coming years as federal coronavirus pandemic money dries up. After receiving a presentation about Florida's long-term financial outlook, top lawmakers expressed optimism that the legislature will again be able to handle spending needs in areas such as education and health care. Senate Appropriations Chairman Doug Broxson says lawmakers have not attached federal pandemic aid to long-term projects or programs since the money started pouring in after the 2020 legislative session. Still, Broxson is cautioning against overspending.
I would hope that we would continue to be the state that stays within our budget and does not put additional pressure on already overpressured taxpayers as we move forward.
State economists told lawmakers that the state could go from a $2 billion surplus during the upcoming 2025-2026 fiscal year to a potential deficit of nearly $3 billion in the 2026-2027 fiscal year. The projections are based on lawmakers continuing current patterns of spending and tax breaks while the state continues to rapidly grow. Coming up on Capitol Report, for a growing number of people who have mental health issues, a stay in a Florida jail or prison is essentially a death sentence.
And so they end up in our jails and our prisons, and oftentimes they end up in solitary confinement because even the jails and prisons don't know what to do with them.
A Florida program to help kids with disabilities get ready for great careers is looking to grow the number of students it serves.
It's our intention to go from 1,200 students a year to 5,000 students a year in the next 4 years.
And speaking of careers, Florida is also ramping up the number of student nurses in the pipeline in response to rapidly growing needs.
We've invested close to $400 million in nursing education alone. I don't think anyone else in the country has been able to do that.
Conditions in Florida's prisons and jails are an ongoing problem, but the question of deaths behind bars isn't studied enough. So far this year, the Leon County Detention Facility has seen 6 inmates die from a range of causes. That's a lot for Leon, and well above similar facilities in Florida. But as Margie Menzel reports, it's consistent with the increase in incarceration deaths across the country.
One man died of a stroke. A woman died of what's being described as a blood intoxication. An inflamed stomach lining claimed the life of a third person, and another death was heart-related. The causes of the two remaining deaths have been redacted in public records, but a jail official says one man was found hanging in his cell, with no one else there.
We also have had several die of natural causes, as determined by the medical examiner.
Leon County Undersheriff Ron Cave says people who come to the jail often haven't had much access to health care before they arrive, or they have pre-existing health conditions.
And then we've had some instances where people have ingested drugs into their system, unfortunately, just prior to being arrested.
The situation in Leon is consistent with research studies. A 2022 National Institutes of Health report found that on average, there are roughly 1.4 deaths per 1,000 incarcerated people annually. Of those, 44% are illness-related, one-third are suicides, and about 10% are due to drugs and alcohol. That means that more than 40% of deaths are due to either suicide or are drug-related. an issue that the Florida Sheriff's Association's Corey Godwin says has been an ongoing trend for decades.
Those with behavioral health issues, not only behavioral health, but substance abuse or addiction disorders, or more commonly, a dual diagnosis with both, obviously are ending up into our correctional facilities and jails across the nation. And Florida's certainly not been immune to that.
Former State Senator Jeff Brandis is the founder of the Florida Policy Project, a nonprofit think tank focusing on best practices in criminal justice, housing, transportation, and insurance. He says that jails and prisons are being asked to function as treatment facilities for people with mental health issues.
And so they end up in our jails and our prisons, and oftentimes they end up in solitary confinement because even the jails and prisons don't know what to do with them. And that leads to a spiral of these individuals, right? They're, you know, putting these individuals in a room by themselves for hours, sometimes days on end. It does not improve their mental state. And we do not currently allocate the resources necessary to deal with this growing population in our jails and prisons.
According to the Florida Department of Corrections, there were 29 suicides statewide in fiscal year 2022-2023 and 321 natural deaths. The figures have remained relatively consistent over the past few years. The federal study from 2022 also emphasizes how jails and prisons can often make existing mental health issues worse. Denise Rock couldn't agree more. She's the executive director and founder of Florida Cares Charity, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of the incarcerated. She says reaching people with mental health issues early is exactly what's needed. The earlier, the better.
Less police officers, more counselors and therapists, and start addressing the mental health issues, which actually snowball once drug issues come into play, right? And many people that have mental health issues treat with street drugs, and that, you know, exacerbates the problem.
Judge Steve Lifeman is an expert on the intersection of criminal justice and mental health. He works at the Criminal Division of the Miami-Dade County Court and says it's essential to use highly trained professionals to screen new inmates for the risk of suicide. The Miami-Dade Jail uses a professional screener from the Jackson Memorial Hospital Correction Health Services.
And so if there's any indication that there may be any kind of behavioral health issues, the person is segregated immediately at the jail, and they're seen by a psychiatrist pretty quickly, and, you know, extra eyes are kept on them to make sure that there's no suicide risk or suicide attempt.
Leon's Cave says the sheriff's department has taken steps to mitigate inmate suicides. They've substituted high-tech materials for sheets and blankets that could be used for hangings and welded holes shut to prevent their being used for leverage in such deaths. The department has also consulted with Florida State University, the Appalachie Center, and a suicide mitigation expert.
If persons are going through personal challenges on the outside, that's going to obviously have an impact internally. So we created a form now where at check-on, when staff come in, they are advised of, all right, you know, inmate X just got sentenced to, you know, 3 years in prison. We need to pay a close watch on them. Even if they don't proactively say anything, we're going to, you know.
As to the recent deaths, Cave says inmates with health issues already have medical care on site. In the last year, the facility has created a behavioral health unit with an advanced registered nurse practitioner who comes in 4 days a week and a psychiatrist who is there when the nurse is not. I'm Margie Menzel.
We're joined on Capitol Report this week by
Allison Chase, and I'm the president and CEO of the Able Trust.
Well, it seems you folks at the Able Trust are marking a pretty gala anniversary there, Allison.
this school year is our 30th anniversary of the Florida High School High Tech Program. So it's a program that we've run for youth with disabilities all throughout the state for 30 years now. And it helps students with disabilities get to explore different career opportunities, get to learn what they like, what they don't like, and be prepared for what comes after high school, which our primary goal for them is post-secondary education.
In recent years, there's been a revival of the idea that secondary education needs to cover not only academics, but also preparation for what I guess could be called careers in the trades. So does the high school high-tech program focus on that, or is it a more comprehensive kind of thing?
A lot of people, when they hear the name high school high tech, often think of technology, STEM related careers, which the program did start 30 years focusing on that. But what we've found over the course of 30 years is that we really need to focus on, as you said, beyond that. So the wide variety of good jobs, growing jobs, in-demand industries that we have here in Florida. So, for example, we have a group of brothers that went through our program down at Wakulla High School. So we operate the program in coordination with local nonprofits and with school districts. In Wakulla County, they work with Wakulla High School. And we had a group of brothers who went through and really focused on all of the career and technical education certifications that were available. A couple of them did welding. One particular brother in particular really wants to be a mechanic. So he has taken advantage of all of the different certifications from safety to brakes to steering to transmission, and was part of a cool project where the school had a former military vehicle that they took and turned into a hot rod. So he did all of that and got his high school degree and is now in the world of work and becoming a mechanic.
I recall seeing somewhere that folks with disabilities tend to have better concentration, dedication, and work ethic than many fully abled people.
That's correct. You know, employers are really looking for the kind of work ethic that we're trying to help students attain. The types of experiences aren't just about career, you know, exploring careers, but it's getting those soft skills, getting those communication skills, working in teams, all of the kinds of things that you hear employers talk about. Well, yeah, they have the education, but I can teach them how to do the job, but I can't teach them to show up on time. I can't teach them to be a good team player. I can't teach them to think critically. And that's what High School High Tech is really trying to do.
Allison, what's the current state funding status of the ABLE Trust, and do you have any concerns about the level of that support as we head towards the 2025 session?
We're a direct support organization, and we support the Department of Education, their vocational rehabilitation program. We recently doubled our funding that we get for high school high tech, so we get a little over $1 million. We also got $300,000 this past year to do an expansion that is a spinoff of high school high tech called Futures in Focus. So one of the things that we know is that disability employment, disability services, it's really a nonpartisan issues. So we have friends on both sides of the aisle. We have had 30 years of great success with the program, so we have a lot of champions within the legislature. So I can't say that we're really worried about anything. We just, you know, what our focus is for the 2025 session is telling our story, telling our students' stories, celebrating the 30-year history and partnership that we have with the Department of Education, but also with the legislature, because this is something that they fund and that they can be proud of. And we want to help their constituents know about what's happening with high school high tech in their backyards, because we have sites in 47 locations throughout the state. We want to continue to grow. We're launching a campaign in the next couple of weeks to do just that. It's our intention to go from 1,200 students a year to 5,000 students a year in the next 4 years. So lots of partnerships to grow and develop, and the legislature is one of them.
That 5,000 student goal is a big step up for sure, but when you look at the entire state, I kind of suspect it's just a fraction of the total need that's out there.
You are right. There are over 200,000 students in public high schools alone that have disabilities. And our long-term moonshot goal is that every student with a disability that's in a high school has access to high school high tech. But one of the things that we know is that we have to grow slowly and intentionally because we are very serious about maintaining the fidelity of the program, the quality outcomes that we achieve. And because we do it in partnership with other organizations and school districts, we have to nurture those partnerships. We're not just a funder of the program. We're really involved with the administration of it and supporting those local sites. So as you said, it's not insignificant, but it's also a drop in the bucket, right? So my long-term vision, like I said, is that we will have all students with disabilities will have access to high school high tech. I don't know if that's going to happen in my lifetime, but the legislature is going to be a big part of that. And I think we just continue to show them the good work that we're able to do with their support and partnership.
Allison Chase, President and CEO of the ABLE Trust, joining us on Capitol Report this week. Thanks, Allison. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Governor Ron DeSantis is touting efforts to grow the state's nursing workforce. More than 1,800 nursing students graduated from the state university system this year, a number DeSantis calls a record. Regan McCarthy reports.
Alexis Shea has wanted to be a nurse for as long as she can remember.
And now I'm living my dream.
Shea is a nursing student at Daytona State College. She also works at Halifax Health.
Throughout my time working at Halifax, I've been given some of the most wonderful opportunities, from building patient interaction skills to playing checkers with a sick child in pediatrics, making their day more than just a boring visit in the hospital.
Shea says becoming a nurse is a dream that might have been out of reach without a LINE scholarship. LINE stands for Linking Industry to Nursing Education. Lawmakers created the program in 2022 as part of an attempt to address Florida's looming nursing shortage. It offers matching dollars to encourage healthcare education programs to partner with healthcare providers, like Daytona State College and Halifax Health. The state also created the Pipeline Program. That acronym stands for Prepping Institution Programs, Employers, and Learners through Incentives for Nursing Education. It rewards nursing programs for their students' success.
We've invested close to $400 million in nursing education alone. I don't think anyone else in the country has been able to do that.
Governor Ron DeSantis says that investment is starting to pay off.
Because of these investments, enrollment in Associate of Science in Nursing programs at our state colleges has increased by 25%. Additionally, the number of those completing the course increased by 24%.
DeSantis has pledged more funding for both programs in the coming fiscal year's budget. Right now, more than 3 million registered nurses are employed in the state. But officials say that's not enough, especially as the state's population continues to age. A 2021 study by the Florida Hospital Association found Florida is expected to face a shortage of 59,000 nurses by the year 2035. DeSantis is hopeful continued funding for nurse education programs like the LINE and pipeline funds will help to curb that. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Woods. Thanks also to Dara Camp. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.